In 2007, Coloradan Miguel Peña Rodriguez was convicted of misdemeanors related to groping two teenage girls. Later, he learned that a juror in the case had allegedly said that Peña Rodriguez was guilty because he was Mexican, saying that Mexican men, quote, had a bravado that caused them to believe they could do whatever they wanted with women. So in 2017, the Supreme Court sent the case of Miguel Peña Rodriguez back down to the lower courts. And that case, along with some other recent decisions, established a precedent for how courts rule in cases where jurors display racial bias. But what about demonstrations of a juror's bias around someone's sexual orientation? Does the same precedent hold? This Thursday, the Supreme Court will decide whether to take on a case that could answer that question. Maurice Shema is here to explain. He's a staff writer at the Marshall Project and author of this week's Case in Point. Maurice, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So this is a case that goes back to 1993. Charles Rimes was sentenced to death for fatally stabbing a man. Tell us a little bit more about the facts surrounding the murder.
Sure. So Charles Rimes, in 1992, went to rob a donut store in Rapid City, South Dakota, and there was an employee there named Donovan Schaefer, and Rimes stabbed him as he stole money from the shop. The jury then found him guilty the next year, and they had this question of whether to sentence him to death or give him life in prison. And when it came time in the jury room to decide what to do next, they sent out a list of questions to the judge saying, you know, will he have a cellmate? Will he be able to create a group of admirers in the prison? Will he be able to brag about his crime to younger prisoners? There were these sort of weird implications around sexuality, but they were very subtle and very under the surface. And then a couple of decades later, his lawyers went back and found these jurors and discovered that in the jury room, there had been some discussion of the fact that Mr. Rimes is gay, and that there was an idea that if he were sentenced to life in prison, that he would like it because he's a man and would be in a male prison, which is sort of shocking on its face.
Well, you were able to speak to a juror, Frances Cerso-Simo, and we're going to play a clip from a conversation with her.
He had made the statement, well, if they have all these privileges and if he's gay, it might not be so bad for him. As I recall, the murmur from many of the jurors in the room was like, what? Meaning, really? He immediately said that that was a stupid thing to say. We moved on with our discussion. I firmly believe Charles Rimes being gay had no bearing on the unanimous decision for the death penalty that he was given.
Maurice, is what she's saying, is what Frances is saying there consistent with what the other members of the jury told you?
That's kind of the problem, that we're talking about what happened in a jury room 25 years ago, and you have 12 people with 12 different memories. So I spoke to three jurors. Frances remembered this one comment. Another juror didn't remember the comment at all. Another juror, I reached his wife, and he now has dementia, and so he doesn't remember what happened in the jury room. If you look at the court documents that were filed by investigators for the defense, they found that a handful of jurors, more than just Frances, another two, said explicitly, we sentenced him to death in part because we didn't think he should be able to spend the rest of his life in a prison with men. They were somewhat explicit about it. Then, a few years after that, the state sends out its own investigator who finds a bunch of jurors, some of whom slam the door on them, some of them say, I'm tired of being harassed, but then some of whom say, no, that never happened. We solely based our decision on the fact that the crime was very brutal. He stabbed this man, I think, in the neck. He went and ate an order of French fries afterwards. It was a very, very gruesome crime, and the crime alone was the reason that we sentenced him to death. Frances openly said there was this passing comment that was made. Some other jurors said, I just don't remember that. Maybe it happened. Again, we're talking about 25 years later. And that really gets into how tough these cases can be when you talk about sort of re-examining what jurors thought and felt and said to each other when they weren't recorded and memories are fuzzy and decades pass.
And for those of our listeners who haven't been in a jury room or who haven't served on a jury, I mean, jurors are repeatedly told to stick to the facts of the case, not to get emotional about these decisions. How could this note have made its way so many years ago without sort of raising any red flags then?
Well, I think it's because the questions in that note are pretty subtle. I mean, in the sense that, you know, on first read, I'm not sure that if I saw, you know, a note that said, will he have a cellmate? Could he create a group of admirers? That, I mean, could just signal, you know, we're concerned that life in prison wouldn't be fully punitive enough for this man. You know, if the judge had said, come back and said, no, he's going to be in his cell 24 hours a day, it's going to be very brutal, maybe the jurors would have said, oh, well, then a life sentence is okay. So they wanted some context there.
What I find stunning about this is that there are levels of punitive that apparently the jury, so far from what I'm hearing, is deciding on. Like it's not enough to lock somebody up for life, right? That we need to take it another step further.
Right. And I mean, you know, jurors are always told to stick to the facts of a case. But in a death penalty context, they've already found someone guilty. And this is a separate conversation about the best punishment. And it's sort of hard to imagine how that couldn't become related to emotion, right? Because the death penalty is such a extreme sanction for a crime. Life in prison is also an extreme sanction. So you can imagine that people are, and I've interviewed jurors in many other cases as well, you know, there's this conversation that happens about, you know, this person did this really terrible thing, what is appropriate for them? And emotion gets into that. It's sort of inevitable, I think.
Now, we mentioned the Supreme Court has actually ruled on racial bias in the jury room and the limits of that. How could those rulings influence what we're expected to see when SCOTUS takes this case up later this week?
So later this week, they're going to decide whether to take this case on. They could decide not to take it, but wait for it to kind of percolate in the lower courts more. They could wait for it to come back to them again. But really, the central question here is that, you know, for many, many decades, it was a kind of article of faith. It was a part of our law that what happens in the jury room sort of stays in the jury room, that what jurors thought and felt and said to each other isn't something you can really unpack on appeal and overturn a sentence on. That changed once they started looking at these racial bias cases. They said that can't fly. And so now the question is, well, does sexual orientation count in the same way? And if it does count, what needs to happen for something to rise to that level, right? Do the jurors have to say something explicit? You know, they all said in when they were originally sort of selected for the jury that they could take into account the fact that he was gay and they wouldn't be biased about it. Are you challenging them and saying that they were lying, right? So there's all these questions that suddenly come up if you sort of open the box on what happens in the jury room in terms of sexual orientation. I could also imagine that a skeptic might come and say to the court, well, it's a slippery slope. If you open it up to sexual orientation, what about ageism? What about gender? What about, and you could just see that list of whataboutes could grow. Charles Rines's lawyers say, no, this is pretty simple. Sexual orientation and race are both these sort of special protected categories. We have entire sort of bodies of jurisprudence that protect these classes of people. And so, you know, this neatly fits within that. And we don't have to sort of open up the box in a really big way. But I think that that's kind of the dynamic that we should expect if this case were to be taken up and argued.
Maurice Chamas is a staff writer at the Marshall Project. Thanks for being with us, Maurice.
Thank you.